This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
All right, testing. Oh, that seems to work. Good to see everybody. Thank you for coming out, and we're looking forward to productive and thoughtful afternoon with you all. I'm Greg Johnson, director of the Walter H. Kapp Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life here at UCSB. This is our annual Ethics and Public Policy Forum, and we are delighted to have our guest, Professor Mary Ziegler, with us. We'll have a proper introduction in a moment, but just want to acknowledge that she took time out of a busy schedule to be here with us at a time that feels, I think, perilous for all of us, regardless of where we are on the political spectrum. These are tough times, and we'll be dealing with one of the key issues of the day. So thank you for being here. I want to acknowledge that we're on Chumash land, and Chumash ancestors are in this very land on our campus. They're in the buildings of this campus. Chumash peoples are among us still today, of course. They're looking forward to a productive future working with the university. That hasn't always been the case. I think we're turning the corner with our Chumash neighbors as a university, and I think there are good reasons to believe we'll continue to do good things with them into the future if the university can find the will and resources to back up that vision. I want to thank our co-sponsors, Health Humanities, Legal Humanities, the Department of Feminist Studies, the Feminist Futures Initiative, and the Santa Barbara Women's Health Coalition. Now I'm going to turn things over to Carrie Robinson, who is Associate Director of Health Humanities, Legal Humanities, as well as a board member of the Santa Barbara Women's Health Coalition and the American Indian Health Services here in Santa Barbara. So please welcome Carrie Robinson.
Okay, let's see here. Hi, everybody. It's an honor today to introduce Professor Mary Ziegler. Without exaggeration, it would require the allotted lecture time to provide a full list of her accomplishments, so I will be brief. But I do encourage you to take a peek at her faculty page at UC Davis for a full set of her publications, awards, and service positions. It's really impressive. Professor Ziegler received her BA in English at Harvard University and then went on to do her Juris Doctorate, her law degree, at Harvard Law School. That was in 2007. In addition to a number of service-oriented positions in legal studies and even in the broader world, she was just telling me that she is put it on a faculty panel to create a Smithsonian Museum of U.S. Women's History. In addition to that work, she is a tenured faculty member at the University of California, Davis since 2022. In 2023 and 24, she was a Guggenheim Fellow and is the prolific author of 7 books pertaining to the history of abortion law in the U.S. context. She is also the editor of a large volume that explores abortion rights in an international framework. Beyond this scholarship, what distinguishes Professor Ziegler is her commitment to bridging academic analyses with larger public media. She is a regular contributor to newspapers and online publications, where she tirelessly works to educate the American populace on the changing landscape of reproductive rights, and further, how those rights are directly tied to other First Amendment concerns, such as the right to free speech, for example, the right of a medical provider to discuss pregnancy options with a patient, the right of privacy, as it has been previously understood and constructed by courts to encompass sexuality and marriage, and the right to peacefully assemble, but not harass, for example, those entering an abortion clinic. When Project 2025 advocated for the use of the Comstock Act as a means of implementing a national abortion ban, Professor Ziegler helped translate this arcane legal text into intelligible terms so that non-lawyers in the American public might have some grasp of what is at stake in this debate, and a debate that may well play out at the Supreme Court. Just prior to this lecture, for example, Professor Ziegler did an interview with PBS News Hour on this very subject. This was just a couple hours ago. This coming April, Professor Ziegler's new book, Personhood, The New Civil War Over Reproduction, will be released. Her lecture today will be based on this manuscript, which will explore the history of fetal personhood and its broader ramifications for reproductive justice, such as the criminalization of pregnant women, access to IVF, and legal concepts such as equal treatment under law. Several decades back, when I was conducting interviews in Berlin over a new abortion law that was being implemented there post-unification, there were a number of occasions when I was asked what Americans were doing to ensure access to reproductive rights in the U.S. I naively replied, we've got Roe versus Wade. This court case had firmly established the legal right to abortion. And yes, while that access had been eroded by Casey in 1993, nonetheless, the concept of stare decisis, the fundamental principle that this was established law, I felt protected American access to abortion. The uniform response of my interview partners, largely counselors performing pro-life counseling as required by law, and the patients who are making these pregnancy decisions, was that this was very short-sighted on the part of American women and the larger population. And without an ongoing and organized movement to retain these rights, American reproductive futures were in danger, even if I couldn't see that at the time. Sadly, how accurate this viewpoint was. When I am asked what hope I see going forward, my answer always begins with, we must understand the history of abortion law, both domestically and internationally, and the complexities of the current legal landscape in order to create the most effective and agile countermovement. Professor Ziegler's corpus of work is an excellent foundation towards that important goal. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ziegler to UCSB.
Thanks, everybody. So this book project started really immediately after Roe was overturned. So I had to write an op-ed for the New York Times making sense of what happened, and I was on TV all the time, and a colleague said, what are you going to do now? Because it's over. You know, you won't have anything to write about. Which, of course, would have been really great, but turned out to be really false. Because, of course, in a sense, what this conflict was about for abortion opponents was never getting rid of Roe. It was always about more than that. Because from the 1960s onward, the anti-abortion movement has been a fetal personhood movement. And that has come into the light in really unprecedented ways since Roe was overturned. We've seen it when there was a massive response to the Alabama Supreme Court in 2024, when that court treated frozen embryos as children, putting a temporary halt to in vitro fertilization services in that state. We've seen it in a spike in prosecutions of people for pregnancy-related conduct that isn't abortion-specific, usually substance use, but sometimes other things, like disposing of fetal remains after a miscarriage. And we've seen it even this legislative session in a spate of bills that propose punishing pregnant people and women for pursuing abortions, not just providers and people who aid or abet them, as the legal language would go. But of course, the other thing that's striking is that if you poll Americans, for example, as Pew Forum did in May 2022, the month before the Supreme Court overturned Roe, Pew asked people what were supposed to be questions that would identify someone as pro-choice or pro-life. So one of the questions was, do you think that there is a right to choose abortion? And that abortion should generally be legal. And another question was, do you think that the unborn child has a right to life and that life begins at conception? And they found that over a third of people answered yes to both of those things. And so one of the puzzling questions is, how did we end up in an America where those two realities can't coexist in law? And where, in fact, fetal personhood or enforcement of fetal personhood is synonymous with at least some form of criminal punishment, which isn't true in other countries. It isn't true, for example, in Germany. As Professor Robinson was saying, it isn't true in South Korea. So that was sort of the puzzle that I embarked on in writing this book. And it's a deeply consequential one because the anti-abortion movement understands that the only path to a national ban in the United States really runs through the federal courts. There will be no such ban passed by Congress, even regardless really of who controls Congress, regardless of who is in the White House. There's no really natural way for a president to create one unilaterally using executive action. So the path forward, as abortion opponents understand, is to convince the Supreme Court that the word person in the 14th Amendment, which is what gives us due process and equal protection, in fact applies the moment an egg is fertilized, and that therefore liberal abortion laws, including those passed directly by voters, in fact are themselves unconstitutional. So in other words, what the anti-abortion movement is seeking is sort of a Roe v. Wade of its own. And that, I think, is the next civil war over reproduction to which I'm referring. So, So the question is sort of, when did this begin? So to hear abortion opponents tell it, the framers of the 14th Amendment, the framers of our Constitution, believed that a fetus or unborn child or embryo was a person. But there's very little evidence of that. So there certainly was an anti-abortion movement in the 19th century. It was not really until the 19th century that abortion was criminalized throughout pregnancy in the United States. Up until that point, it was criminalized until quickening, the point at which fetal movement could be detected, which varies from pregnancy to pregnancy. Sometimes, you know, the 12th week of pregnancy, sometimes the 16th of pregnancy, sometimes even the 20th week of pregnancy. There was no reliable way to identify that someone was pregnant before. Doctors would use super reliable methods like sticking their fingers in people's noses, which I'm sure as you've tested at home, you all know if you're pregnant if you stick at least one finger up your nose. So they really had to rely on pregnant people to know if people were pregnant. There was no other really documentable way. The anti-abortion movement was led at the time, ironically, by physicians, including Nathan Smith Davis, this cheerful-looking guy here. The American Medical Association was just mobilizing at the time and was convinced that on multiple grounds, there were way too many abortions happening in the United States in the 19th century. They were worried about this on what we would sort of view as nativist or eugenic grounds, that the people who were having abortions were overwhelmingly likely to be white Protestant women, and that immigrant women, predominantly Irish Catholic women, were having lots of children, and this was a deep concern to the American Medical Association. Members of the American Medical Association also believed that life began at conception, not at quickening, and that they were simply in a better position scientifically to understand that. They were also worried deeply about the roles of women, married women in particular, who were not having children while having sex with their husbands, and in the view of people like Davis, acting as little more than prostitutes, as he and his colleagues would put it. So there was a pretty vigorous movement to criminalize abortion and an argument that abortion was murder or the taking of a human life. But there was no argument that there was a constitutional mandate to criminalize abortion. In other words, that you had to do it because the Constitution told you to. There was also almost no argument at the time by the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment that what they were doing had anything to do with abortion. And this was striking because at the time there was a pretty robust debate about what it meant constitutionally to be a person. So Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, for example, was responding to a Supreme Court decision in 1857 called Dred Scott versus Sanford that involved a man of color, an enslaved man, who had traveled with his owner to Illinois and claimed that at that point he became free. And he returned to Missouri and filed a freedom suit. And the U.S. Supreme Court, courtesy of Justice Roger Taney, answered that Dred Scott couldn't even bring the suit because people of African descent could never be citizens. And people like Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass argued that Dred Scott had it all wrong. And the question wasn't whether Dred Scott and other people of color were citizens, but rather whether they were persons, because the Constitution conferred some rights on persons. This is exactly the argument later generations of abortion opponents would make, but at the time, nobody thought to make it because nobody thought really about constitutional rights in the way we do now. So all of this means I'm really skeptical that there's any argument that we have to recognize fetal personhood under the Constitution, even if that's what people are going to argue to the Supreme Court. So when did this get started? It got started in the 1960s. So this was really the first time that there was a push to reform abortion laws in places like California. And the early anti-abortion movement, which was primarily Catholic, was struggling to explain why criminal abortion laws were still desirable. So at first they argued that there was no need for abortion, essentially that pregnancy was no longer dangerous, which turned out not to be true, particularly for people of color for whom pregnancy was more dangerous, right? Rates of maternal mortality and morbidity were up for people who were relying on municipal hospitals for their care. They argued, too, at times that abortion was problematic because it would lead to sexual promiscuity or immorality. But that ultimately seemed to hurt, too. You would see reformers in places like the California legislature responding that morality was a matter for each individual to decide. It wasn't something that the state should be legislating. And so leading abortion opponents like the ones pictured here began arguing instead that it was just unconstitutional to permit abortion. It didn't matter if people wanted to do it. It didn't matter if it would be better from a policy standpoint. It just wasn't allowable at all. And there were different arguments they experimented with. They experimented with procedural due process. So in law, if you think about due process, usually the idea is you get to have a lawyer or a hearing or something before people take your stuff away, whether that's your property, your life, or your liberty. And so the argument was, if we provide due process to, for example, accused criminals, surely we should do the same for the innocent unborn child. But the problem with that argument was that ultimately all it got you was procedure, right? So maybe you would have a guardian appointed for a fetus before an abortion, but then the abortion might happen anyway. So that wasn't what the movement wanted. They tried what lawyers would call substantive due process arguments, right? The idea that the Constitution implies the existence of rights that aren't spelled out. So if you pull up the Constitution on your phone and control F privacy, you won't find it. It's one of the many implied rights. There's no right to marry that you will find either. So there's some rights that are implied but not spelled out. And so abortion opponents argued, well, if that's true, surely there must be a right to life because you can't exercise the other rights you have if you're not alive. But that argument was problematic too. The Supreme Court didn't and doesn't seem to be in the business of recognizing new rights. And what was more, abortion reformers were increasingly arguing about equality. They recognized that criminal abortion laws were having a disproportionate impact on low-income people and people of color in particular. At hospitals, private hospitals for people with private insurance, abortion had become relatively safe by the 1960s, and rates of maternal mortality and morbidity related to pregnancy were down in general. But municipal hospitals and Catholic hospitals almost never offered abortion, even in cases of miscarriage management and stillbirth. And for people of color in particular, rates of abortion-related mortality and morbidity were up. And so for people like Pat McGinnis, who's pictured here, who I think was on the UCSB campus in the 60s lecturing about this, they argued that abortion was a problem of equality, because no matter what you thought about its morality or legality, it was available, clearly only safely available to people with resources and not available to people without. And so that led abortion opponents to think that they needed an equality argument too. And initially, what they were proposing to do, and I think still what they're proposing to do, is to revolutionize how we think of equality in general. So this was just at the time that the Supreme Court was beginning to say that it's not okay to classify people on the basis of race. And that the reason it's not okay to classify people on the basis of race is because people of color have experienced a history of subordination in the United States, and because they have an immutable trait that makes them eligible or likely to face that kind of discrimination. And so abortion opponents like Robert Byrne, who's pictured here, the press had a lot of fun with the fact that he lived with his mother, I don't know why. He argued that, in fact, the fetus or unborn child was exactly like people of color, that the fetus or unborn child was being discriminated against or victimized because of a trait over which that person had no control. Of course, that argument was problematic in some ways, right? people responded, well, a fetus is dependent on another for survival in a way that people of color are not. That, for example, that's a real difference, right? In equality law, you are allowed to treat people differently if they actually are different. You just can't treat them differently based on stereotypes. But abortion opponents argued that that was all wrong, and that, in fact, a history of subordination was irrelevant to equality law, and that what really mattered was physical vulnerability. So the idea was we shouldn't have an equality jurisprudence centered on things like people of color or women. We should have an equality jurisprudence centered on people with disabilities, the elderly, and, of course, the unborn child. And this argument became really important to an anti-abortion movement that was growing in the 1960s. One of the things that makes personhood compelling to people, had made personhood compelling to people on the right in the United States for decades, is that no one knew exactly what it meant or how it would be enforced. So the anti-abortion movement in the 60s was more ideologically diverse, than you might expect, on questions of race. So there were people in the anti-abortion movement, primarily Catholics, who joined the civil rights movement, or at least sympathized with the civil rights movement, and people who thought the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is the kind of landmark employment discrimination law, was itself discriminating against white people. There were people who disagreed about the women's movement and about whether there should be an Equal Rights Amendment guaranteeing protection against sex discrimination, or whether the Equal Rights Amendment was diabolical. There was even disagreement about how to treat children who are born outside of marriage. So personhood, in some ways, was the answer for everything, right? Everybody agreed that personhood was the ideal. Everybody agreed that personhood was the moonshot. And they could postpone indefinitely the question about exactly how personhood would be enforced in an ideal world. Just like me and the clicker, how the clicker would work in an ideal world. This argument began to change as racial dynamics changed, too. So by the late 60s and 70s, there was a pretty virulent backlash against the civil rights movement, against school integration, which was relabeled busing. And white conservative and moderate scholars began arguing that really the problem with discrimination in the United States wasn't the subordination of people of color or other people who had been victimized, but rather just categorizing people on the basis of race, saying, you know, this person can get into this program and this person can't. It was a very sort of anti-DEI moment. And abortion opponents began borrowing from that argument too, saying that the problem with abortion was the same problem with affirmative action. In other words, that it was categorizing the unborn child based on their residence in the womb rather than on their traits as individuals. So this too was kind of a broader program, not just to criminalize abortion, but to change what we mean when we think of equality. Now, you would have thought that might have gone away when the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade, but it didn't. The anti-abortion movement's agenda for the first decade after Roe v. Wade was not to overrule Roe v. Wade. It was to institute constitutional fetal personhood in a way that would criminalize abortion nationwide, and potentially things like IVF too, via what folks called the Human Life Amendment. One of them was proposed by Senator James Buckley of New York, pictured here, but there were many others as well. And the Human Life Amendment forced, to some degree, abortion opponents to figure out what it would actually mean to treat the fetus or unborn child as a person. And it turned out that there was a lot of disagreement about this. So some abortion opponents asked, well, if a fetus is a child or a person, does that mean the government actually has an obligation to treat pregnant people better? Does the government, for example, have an obligation to give people health care? As we saw after Roe was overturned, does that mean that pregnant people get to drive in the HOV lane? In other words, do we have to confer rights on pregnant people in order to give rights to fetal people? Other abortion opponents thought it meant there could be no exceptions to abortion bans, because, of course, if a child of 10 years old was conceived as a result of sexual assault, we don't allow that child to be killed. If there is a threat to a pregnant person's life, they would argue, we only allow the killing of another person in self-defense, but surely an unborn child isn't an aggressor. So they argued there should be no exceptions at all. These debates ultimately turned out to be academic because Congress didn't have the votes to pass such an amendment, even after the anti-abortion movement aligned with the GOP. This was not a partisan issue for a long time. Even after the GOP won everything in 1980 in a moment reminiscent of ours, The movement couldn't get the votes in Congress, even for a statute recognizing fetal personhood, even for a constitutional amendment saying Roe was wrong. So movement did what movements do when they can't agree, which was basically nothing. And so that fast forwarded to a moment where the question was sort of what to do then, if your whole movement was about constitutional personhood and you couldn't get it. And so the movement retooled what personhood meant to fit a moment where Ronald Reagan was the president and where Ronald Reagan was embarking on an agenda, a tough on crime agenda, that would transform the percentage of people and raw number of people incarcerated in the United States really forever. So at this time, Reagan had himself almost been assassinated and then used what he called a victims' rights agenda to build private prisons and establish mandatory minimum sentences. And abortion opponents, far from giving up on the fight to create fetal rights, created a stealth campaign to do so in areas of the law unrelated to abortion. This included fetal homicide laws, which are still on the books in places like California, laws involving wrongful death, primarily those things. And the argument was that, one, this was compatible with Roe v. Wade, but two, and more importantly, that the way you created equality in the United States, or the way that you vindicated the rights of victims, was not to lift victims up, but to punish people who had wronged victims, right? So the way that you did justice to the unborn child was not to help the pregnant person or make abortion less likely by giving people who could be pregnant resources before they confronted the choice to have an abortion, but rather to punish people who had wronged the unborn child after the fact. And that was an argument made by Paige Cunningham, who's pictured here, and others. This argument was particularly pronounced in the context of prosecuting pregnant drug users. This was something that became very powerful in the 80s and 90s, and almost overwhelmingly at the time applied to people of color, who were the ones who were screened for drug use at hospitals during pregnancy, often not convicted, though sometimes convicted. And even if they weren't convicted, they often lost custody of their children, sometimes permanently. So this was sort of the way in which fetal personhood was being redefined in the 80s. It was also being redefined constitutionally. So instead of the old argument, which was to say, we do need to protect vulnerable people, but we have the idea of who's vulnerable all wrong, abortion opponents began instead talking about the past. And they did this to align their cause with new arguments being made by conservative Protestants who were mobilizing for the first time and who were arguing that the United States was created as a Christian nation and had an inherently Christian constitution. They were trying to find a way to get these arguments to court in a way that justices would listen to. And they did that in a case called Bowers versus Hardwick. This is Mr. Hardwick here. Bowers versus Hardwick was about sodomy laws, which criminalized oral or anal sex if same-sex couples were having it. And Mr. Hardwick kind of like magically managed to actually get caught having sex by the police, which was not a common, like you have to be, not everybody can do that, right? And so groups like anti-abortion groups were defending sodomy laws. And the way they were doing it was by saying the only rights we should have in this country are rights that are deeply rooted in history and tradition. This was not originalism, right? Some of you may have heard of originalism. Originalism says that we interpret the Constitution based on its original public meaning. But the problem with that, as I've said, is it's not clear that the original public meaning of the Constitution was that there were any fetal rights. And what was more, people who were joining the movement at this time wanted to reach further back to traditions that were overtly Christian at a time when the nation's founding might not have been as overtly Christian. So the Supreme Court seemed sympathetic to this argument in Bowers, and it became a kind of new hook for the anti-abortion movement to talk about the way the Constitution should be understood. Because they argued if you looked at history and tradition, you should understand, one, that tradition shouldn't and can't change, two, that if tradition is what matters, there can be no right to abortion, and three, that there may even be an obligation to punish people who wrong the unborn child. This continued for some time. You began to see tension, though, of course, because in the 90s, abortion opponents were seeing a spike in violence against abortion clinics, including the murder of several doctors, the spread of massive clinic blockades, and along with that, a sense that the anti-abortion movement was anti-woman. And so the anti-abortion movement had to retool its personhood arguments once again, and did so by looking, interestingly enough, at the fight against what was then called Big Tobacco, right? This was the first time when people were suing tobacco companies for addicting people to cigarettes. The challenge, as you can imagine, for these lawsuits is juries would look at smokers and say, well, you know, they knew smoking was bad. They shouldn't be able to sue. It's their own fault for smoking. And the way that prosecutors and plaintiffs' attorneys overcame this was to say that the tobacco industry was so sophisticated and so wealthy that they had kind of perpetuated this massive hoax on smokers who hadn't understood the dangers of smoking until it was too late. Abortion opponents wanted to say the same thing about women, because they understood that if you believed that a fetus or unborn child was a person, and you believed that anyone who harmed that person was a murderer, then surely they were saying women and pregnant people were murderers too. So the way around this problem, they said, was simply to think of abortion providers as big abortion, the equivalent of Big Tobacco, that had perpetuated a massive hoax on people who had no idea what they were choosing when they terminated a pregnancy. This was written into laws that were known as right-to-know laws, right, where you would be told information about fetal development before having an abortion, and sometimes contested or inaccurate information about connections between abortion and post-traumatic stress syndrome or breast cancer. But one of the questions that this postponed that we're seeing come back in a really forceful way is, what happens if somebody does know? Right? What if you can prove that somebody knows what they're doing and is okay with what they're doing? What should we do then? And the movement at the time didn't have to answer that question, and in some ways it didn't. Over time, the anti-abortion movement changed as it aligned more and more with the political right. It, of course, embraced corporate personhood as well as fetal personhood, in part because the anti-abortion movement recognized that simply having a clever litigation strategy and a partnership with the GOP wasn't enough to get Roe overturned. Professor Robinson mentioned the 1992 decision in a case called Casey, at which point the Supreme Court had more than enough Republican justices. Everyone thought Roe would be overturned, and it didn't happen. And the reason seemed to be because the justices were worried that overturning Roe would damage their own legacies and would damage the reputation of the Supreme Court. So the solution, the anti-abortion movement thought, was to change how the GOP picked judges by changing how much influence the anti-abortion movement had in the GOP. And the way to do that, the movement thought, was money. So the anti-abortion movement became one of the biggest forces in changing campaign finance law in the United States. Most of you probably heard of Citizens United versus FEC, the Supreme Court's major campaign finance case. That was litigated by James Bopp, who's pictured here. He was the person who led the case all the way up to the Supreme Court, where he didn't argue it. Bopp is the general counsel of the National Right to Life Committee, which is one of the largest anti-abortion groups in the United States. And his argument essentially was that if more money came into politics, not through political parties, which might want to pick pragmatic winning candidates, but through outside groups like super PACs and nonprofits, that would give more power to people with ideologies like his own, and make it easier for the anti-abortion movement to call the shots when it came to picking Supreme Court justices. So the anti-abortion movement began arguing that corporations should have rights and potentially be treated as persons too. And who the anti-abortion movement was beginning to change in powerful ways. So for many years, the anti-abortion movement had embraced the idea of fetal personhood as a way of saying its movement was not religious, right? It had started in the 1960s to say, we are not a Catholic movement, we are here to promote secular human rights. But over time, as massive groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is, I think, the most important player in the movement today, formed, they were generally conservative Protestant groups funded by televangelists, often with budgets in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, that identified explicitly as Christian and identified their cause not just with criminalizing abortion, but with, for example, prohibiting same-sex marriage, addressing transgender rights, and eventually with addressing in vitro fertilization too. So what personhood meant changed as the anti-abortion movement itself changed. For a time, if you had been around in the 2000s or 2010s, you would have thought of fetal personhood as sort of the fringe of the anti-abortion movement. There was a time when states like Colorado were trying to amend their state constitutions to protect fetal rights, and those amendments were failing. And the narrative in the press was that there was the mainstream anti-abortion movement, which just wanted to get rid of Roe, and then the kind of fringy, weird people who wanted fetal personhood. But the disagreement was never substantive. It was just about timing. Because at that point, no one believed that the Supreme Court would overturn Roe, and in fact believed that these fetal personhood constitutional amendments would give the court an excuse to potentially strengthen Roe. And so it was that things changed pretty dramatically when the court actually overturned Roe in a case called Dobbs. As you may know, the reasoning of Dobbs echoed what people were saying in Bowers versus Hardwick. The Supreme Court in 2022 addressed a Mississippi law banning abortion at 15 weeks that was designed by the Alliance Defending Freedom. And Justice Alito, after the opinion leaked, everyone thought, surely Justice Alito will edit the opinion. Like, can you imagine if you wrote a first draft of a paper, like at midnight or whatever, when you're eating Cheetos, and then you accidentally sent it to your professor, and then your professor gave you really great edits, and you're like, nah, I'm gonna send in the one with the Cheetos. Who cares? That's Justice Alito's. He didn't edit it at all. Maybe edit a little bit, practically not at all. But the substance of Dobbs said, there can be no right to abortion because the only rights we have are rights that are deeply rooted in history and tradition, and that history and tradition don't change, although exactly what history and tradition counts is something that shall remain a mystery to me. But it doesn't post-date 1868. It definitely involves the Middle Ages, and it's sort of the rest is not clear. This idea of history and tradition, of course, Justice Alito said there can be no right to abortion because from his standpoint, throughout history, abortion had been treated as a crime. Strikingly, no one on the court, even Clarence Thomas, which lost me a bet, said anything about fetal personhood. Of course, what they did say suggested that other rights were threatened too, because if you look at history and tradition in the way Justice Alito defined it, there can be no right to contraception. It was precisely in 1868 that the governments were criminalizing contraception for the first time in American history. There obviously can be no right to same-sex marriage. Same-sex couples were not permitted to marry in 1968. And there can be no right even to same-sex intimacy, because it was precisely around that time that states were beginning to criminalize same-sex intimacy specifically instead of just criminalizing oral and anal sex for everyone. So after Dobbs, personhood arguments became much more forceful. They came into the open and they changed. One of the things that changed was the emergence of what's called the abolitionist movement. Abolitionists primarily have emerged in the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest church in the United States. They argue that if, in fact, a fetus or unborn child is a person, there is no logical answer but to punish pregnant people for abortion and indeed for murder. This is a point of view that's gained a lot of influence in the Southern Baptist Convention and various state Baptist conventions, and it's reflected in bills that are being proposed this legislative session in states across the country. Abolitionists, too, have decided to take on IVF, but so have mainstream anti-abortion groups. This became evident in 2024 after the Alabama Supreme Court decided a case called LePage. In LePage, there were three couples who had gone through IVF and stored additional embryos in a facility in Mobile, Alabama. And a psychiatric patient had somehow managed to access the freezer, picked up the embryos, freezer burned his hand, dropped the embryos, and destroyed them. So these families, who understandably were devastated, filed a lawsuit. They first argued that they had suffered emotional distress as a result of the loss of the embryos, but that wasn't the kind of claim courts recognized. So they also argued that they had suffered the wrongful death of a child. And the Alabama Supreme Court agreed with the latter, disagreed with the former, and held that under the state's wrongful death of a minor law, frozen embryos were people. The Chief Justice wrote in a concurring opinion that anyone who destroyed embryos would incur the wrath of God. So IVF temporarily paused in Alabama. The Alabama legislature rushed through a bill to protect IVF. And the anti-abortion movement responded by saying, we are coming for IVF. We want to restrict IVF. IVF is problematic because it requires either the destruction of additional embryos, or even the indefinite storage of additional embryos, which they view as, say, you know, the indefinite storage of, you know, a child in a freezer for long periods of time. So what personhood means now is more punitive than it has before. It's more focused on things beyond abortion, including potentially contraception as well as in vitro fertilization. And none of that is inevitable. One of the things that was striking in writing this book was that we've ended up in a really weird place when it comes to valuing fetal life that other countries have not. So, for example, if states value fetal life, why is it that the first thing they go to is criminalization, right? As opposed to that being a last resort. Why is the first thing they go to not providing more resources for pregnant people, as you would see in other countries? States aren't doing that. Why is it that criminalization is the way we do justice at all? If you incarcerate someone while they're pregnant, it's not clear how that's going to lead to better pregnancy outcomes or better outcomes for the child that would be born as a result of that pregnancy. So I think it's helpful when you look at the past to see that as dysfunctional as a place we may have arrived, it's not inevitable and that there may be better ways of doing this. In other words, that the 33% or so of people in Pew who say, I would like to value fetal life without anyone being incarcerated could be right. You know, maybe they're not deluded. Maybe there's another way of thinking about this that is less disturbing than the one we've decided on. And I think that's some of what I think I'm hoping. One of the things that's concerning, the sort of dark side of this story, is that if fetal personhood is successful, it's going to change not just how we think of abortion, but it's going to change how we think about equality in general. It's always been a project to change how equality law works in the United States for lots of groups of people, not just people who can get pregnant. Another thing that it underscores is where to look if you're looking for where struggles over reproductive rights and justice are going next. And this is the great irony, right? So Justice Alito, who I like to call Sam because we're bros. No, we're not. But he says, you know, what we're doing here is great. We're returning the abortion issue to the people and their elected representatives, like yay democracy. And then it turned out that that wasn't working for a lot of people in the anti-abortion movement because they saw their movement as a human rights movement, not a pro-democracy movement. And so overwhelmingly, the changes they're pursuing now are in the federal courts, not just with respect to personhood. Professor Robinson mentioned the Comstock Act, which is a 19th century obscenity law. People should probably develop drinking games with the Comstock Act because of the number of times it uses words like indecent. It includes some language about abortion, and abortion opponents are arguing that the Supreme Court should overrule, you know, about a century of precedent to say that the Comstock Act prohibits the mailing or receipt of any abortion-related item. In other words, it's a backdoor ban on abortion. There's no way that's going to work unless it goes through the federal courts. There's efforts to challenge access, telehealth access to mifepristone. There's no way that's going to work unless it's through the federal courts. There's no way anything is going to get anywhere without the federal courts. So we're now in a world where the people who were saying for decades Roe is anti-democratic because it's taking issue from the people and their elected representatives, that movement is saying, in fact, we should take the issue from the people and their elected representatives because the stakes are just too high. But I think finally, too, it's good to recognize that other people could make personhood claims, too. If you are focusing so much on fetal personhood, are you erasing the personhood of other people, like people who are being prosecuted for conduct during pregnancy, or even just people who are pregnant altogether? And are you erasing the possibility that there would be a way to honor both the pregnant person and fetus or unborn child with which they're pregnant, which I think is a possibility we've lost to. So I'm hoping that people smarter than this is the great thing about being a historian. I don't have to solve all the problems. I just have to tell you what the problems are. So I will leave that to the rest of you and take your questions. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.